You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Barack Obama has said that he's been reading about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's presidency to prepare for dealing with problems like the economic crisis. In a new book called Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America, Adam Cohn shows how FDR was able to make drastic reforms to steer the country toward economic recovery in his first 3 months in office. Mr. Cohn, an assistant editorial page editor of the New York Times and a former senior writer at Time magazine, is the author of several other books. This latest is published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it brings Adam Cohn to the show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard.
We know that the United States was in the midst of the Great Depression when Roosevelt took office, but can you describe the state of the nation in 1933?
Yeah.
Four years after the crash.
Yes, and things were really bad. The crash had really permeated the entire country at that point. Unemployment was 25%. The stock market was down about 85% from its high. The entire banking system was closed down on Inauguration Day. Every bank had declared a bank holiday. People had lost their life savings. So things were pretty grim.
And what had President Hoover been doing to solve the economic crisis?
Well, he made a few halting steps in various directions, but he really believed in rugged individualism. He thought people should solve their own problems, and he was a free market capitalist. He didn't think the federal government really had much of a role.
Some people saying the same sort of thing today.
Absolutely.
Well, how many parallels can we make between 1933 and 2009?
It's remarkable how many. My brother did proofread the book, and all he kept saying is, it sounds like you're writing about today. Because, I mean, every aspect of it, from the fact that the banking system is what, you know, started a lot of the hard times, the fact that there was a Republican in office who was very unpopular, who was leaving sort of, you know, under a cloud, a Democrat elected on a promise of change and hope, and on and on and on.
Except that we have been told over the past 75 years that we could never have another depression because we put all these safeguards in to protect ourselves against it. And although we're not calling this a depression, it does look pretty similar.
It's true, and we're hearing it now. Ben Bernanke, who is a scholar of the Great Depression, says, you know, this is not a depression, this won't be a depression. But I think it's very hard to, say what this will be. But the parallels are there, and also the fact that, yes, the stock market is not down 85%, but it's down 40 or 50%.
Now, Roosevelt's first job was to reassure people that he'd be able to do things to help them. I mean, it's one thing to say we're going to have change, and he did. It's another thing to actually reassure people that you can affect that change.
That's right. And in his famous inaugural address where he said nothing to fear, he also said action and action now. And people were hungry not just for hope but for concrete action.
Let's listen to something from that address.
This nation is asking for action and action now. Our greatest primary task is to put people to work. This is no unsolvable problem if we face it wisely and courageously.
Now, Barack Obama can be an eloquent speaker, but it's going to be hard to top FDR when it comes to coming up with memorable phrases. That was the fear, nothing to fear but fear itself speech, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, the inaugural address. And not only memorable phrases, but that amazing voice that FDR had that really, powerfully communicated his message.
So do you think that played a role in reassuring people and inspiring the confidence that was necessary?
Absolutely. FDR was a great communicator, and we saw it again in his fireside chats. There were two during the 100 days, and his first one in particular, when the banking system was on the verge of collapse, at the end of the first week, FDR gave a fireside chat, spoke to millions of people in their living rooms over the radio, and essentially told them that the changes that he brought about in the first week were going to save the banking system. They could redeposit their money, and he persuaded people. That was his level of convincingness.
There is a major difference here, and that is that the country had suffered 3+ years of the Depression, so they probably were a lot more anxious to see major change take place. They had given him an incredible mandate. Barack Obama doesn't have as much of a mandate, and he doesn't have as much of a sense of futility yet to deal with.
That's right. I mean, we can't really imagine, even as tough as things are now, 25% unemployment, a banking system completely collapsed. And it was that level of desperation that led Congress essentially to give FDR whatever he wanted. Obama doesn't quite have that level of compliance yet.
And we're not going to see 100 days of success of the sort that we saw with Roosevelt. In fact, Today's Times has an article on the front page about how a lot of the Democrats, along with many Republicans, are not all that happy with some of the proposals they're hearing for economic change.
Right. We're already hearing carping, right, as you say, from both sides of the aisle, whereas FDR had a Congress that, where even the Republicans, by and large, said, we're going to just let the president do what he wants. Things are really grim and let him lead.
Then later they started.
They began to. Opposition. Yeah, absolutely.
But you mentioned the bank holiday. Had he called for that?
It was actually every state individually had a banking holiday by Inauguration Day, and then FDR did declare a national bank holiday.
Did that help?
It did. It gave him time to come up with the Emergency Banking Act during the first week, and that was a reform that allowed banks to reopen carefully on a schedule when they were healthy, and that did really save the system.
Because there was people had to believe that they could trust the banks and that they could invest again in stocks and bonds.
That's right. And in that first fireside chat, FDR explained to them why they could. And someone said, Mark Twain actually said that he explained the banking system so clearly that even the bankers understood it. And he also told them that, you know, they could take their money out from under their mattresses, that it would be safer in the banks. And he persuaded them.
There was also a huge debate over whether going off the gold standard was a good way to address inflation. Why was it such a controversial plan?
Well, Wall Street didn't want to go off the gold standard, but the pressure for that really came from the Farm Belt, where there had been so much deflation that farmers who owed money were being forced to pay off their debts in dollars that had become, you know, much more costly, and it was leading to foreclosures. But the banks who had made those loans did not want to inflate the currency.
And the agricultural crisis was a major thing that he had to address immediately. Farmers were becoming increasingly radicalized.
That's right.
And it's hard to believe today.
Yeah, exactly. Remember, the Depression began really a decade earlier in the Farm Belt. After World War I, crop prices began to plunge. And so they had been living through years of hard times. And when FDR was inaugurated, 1 in 7 farms in Iowa, which was a fairly prosperous farm state, had been foreclosed. And they were actually... there were pitchfork rebellions of a literal sort.
So how did the Roosevelt administration aim to solve those problems, not just the low crop prices, but inflation and farm foreclosures?
Well, Henry Wallace, his amazing agriculture secretary, who came from Iowa, who was a great farm journalist and scientist, came to FDR during the first week and said, we need a major farm bill to rescue the farms. And FDR said, go talk to the farm leaders, find out what they want, do it quickly. And Wallace quickly had a convention of farm leaders in Washington. They all agreed on what was then the hot new idea, which was domestic allotment, which was subsidizing farmers not to grow crops. They got a bill through quickly. Wallace administered it really adeptly, and it made a huge difference. It drove up crop prices.
My guest is Adam Cohen, whose latest book is Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. It's published by the Penguin Press. Did the agriculture reform bill lead to some of the other plans that Roosevelt had, like for home mortgage relief?
Yeah, because there was relief for farm mortgages, which was desperately needed because of all those foreclosures. And then at the same time, they did a program for home mortgage relief. And again, desperately needed. People were losing their homes right and left.
In fact, you write that 1,000 urban homes were being foreclosed on every day in early 1933.
Yeah.
So that I don't know how that compares with the current crisis, but we're seeing, if not a lot of foreclosures, a lot of potential foreclosures.
That's right. And, you know, people say that back then it wasn't uncommon to see families in a place like New York on the sidewalk surrounded by their furniture because they had been evicted, either because they couldn't pay the rent or, you know, maybe because they'd lost a home.
Did the $700 billion bailout of the banking industry in September suggest that the Bush administration is looking to New Deal-type policies for clues as how to solve the current financial crisis?
Absolutely. And, you know, my genesis in writing the book, I didn't know that there'd be a financial crisis now. I didn't know that Barack Obama would be elected. But there was this war on the New Deal that was very hot, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, and people were trying to undo it. And I was looking back and at the origins of it, and Hoover really didn't believe in an activist government. And what's interesting is now there really aren't many Hooverites, or maybe almost no Hooverites. Even George Bush, the most ideologically conservative president we've had in a very long time, believed that we had to step in with that bailout. That's pretty New Deal-ish.
What happened to Grover Norquist in all of this?
Yeah, I mean, he may be the last of the old Hooverites, but, you know, look at what Bush did, and that says a lot.
But it's also not as complete as what FDR did. We've seen a bailout for banks, the auto industry to some degree, but not for individuals. There's been no comprehensive plan for mortgage relief so far, although many people have called for one. Do you think that that's... What do you think the message is to Barack Obama?
Well, I think one of the messages the voters were sending in November was that, in fact, they do want more of those New Deal approaches. And that's one reason I think they voted Democratic. And I think that Obama, you know, is getting that message, which is bring relief down to, you know, the people lower in the pyramid.
Your subtitle is the FDR's inner circle. So this is really not just the story of FDR. It's the story of an inner circle. And interestingly, an inner circle that, like Barack Obama's, wasn't all liberal Democrats.
That's right. I mean, people tend to think of the 100 days as just FDR having these great ideas and getting them through. There were people one level beneath him who had a major role in developing the policies. I mentioned Henry Wallace, but one of the heroes, maybe the hero of the book, is Francis Perkins, who from the very beginning of the 100 days was saying, we need a major relief program, but we also need public works. And there was opposition. People don't really know this, but Roosevelt appointed a very conservative budget director, Lewis Douglas, who didn't believe there was money for any of these things.
He's a Republican.
Yeah, well, he, in today's parlance, he would be a Republican. He also believed in a balanced budget. And he and Perkins were fighting like cats and dogs during the 100 days over public works. And she ended up winning, thankfully.
Another key figure is Raymond Moley, who was Roosevelt's closest advisor during the first 100 days. But he's kind of disappeared.
He's not known now, but back then he was so important that the joke went that Roosevelt was so powerful he could get you a meeting with Raymond Moley. And Moley was on the cover of Time magazine during the 100 days. He was thought of as the man behind the scenes pulling all the strings, but yeah, forgotten largely.
What happened?
Well, he actually had a big falling out with Roosevelt over he got into a conflict with a cabinet member. He ended up getting a job reassignment. And over the course of his life, he became more disenchanted with Roosevelt over the court packing plan in 37. He ended his life as a Goldwater Republican. And when I had to look at his papers for this book, they're at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He became very right wing at the end of his life.
But Roosevelt did want diversity of opinion among his advisors, but not too far?
Right.
What happened when they had a battle royal?
Right. He wanted a diversity of views, but he didn't want obstruction. And with Moley, he had some difficulty. And with Lewis Douglas, Douglas just was so adamant about his very conservative positions. He began saying that the New Deal policies would mean the end of Western civilization, that Douglas also leaves after about a year and a half because FDR couldn't deal with that level of internal opposition.
On the other hand, you say that he would ask a few different people to draft a bill in order to get different ideas and a variety of solutions. Did that work well?
Some people thought it was really chaotic, but yeah, the National Industrial Recovery Act, the major bill at the end of the 100 days, there were three different groups working on it at the same time with different cabinet members. But what was good is that they would all come to Roosevelt and give him, you know, what they wanted, and he would then pick and choose among them. And I think it actually did stimulate a lot of creativity.
My guest is Adam Cohn, assistant editorial page editor at the New York Times, author of The Perfect Store, Inside eBay, a co-author of American Pharaoh, a biography of Mayor Richard J. Daley, and now Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America from the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Adam Cohn, whose latest book is Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America, published by the Penguin Press. The challenge, as I understand it, was to increase spending in order to aid and fund relief efforts, and at the same time cut spending to fix the deficit. How do you manage to balance contradictory goals like that?
Well, FDR came into office with those very contradictory goals. He had given a speech during the campaign in which he favored cutting the federal budget by 25%. A lot of the 100 days was really a struggle by the liberals, Francis Perkins, Harry Hopkins, Henry Wallace, to convince Roosevelt, don't worry so much about the cutting spending, worry more about the spending money for the needy. And, remember, this was before John Maynard Keynes had written his great book, so this was not yet conventional wisdom. But
so they would be pre-Keynesian Keynesians?
They had a sense that this was the right answer and that Lewis Douglas's idea of cutting spending was the wrong answer, and fortunately they persuaded him.
Although he changed his mind later, and some people say that prolonged the Depression.
Yeah, things were actually improving quite a bit. And then 1937 to 1938, FDR decides to cut spending because he really does believe in balanced budgets. And then that caused another little recession.
The 1929 stock market crash was seen as the cause of the Great Depression, and Roosevelt campaigned on creating regulation. What kinds of government regulation had existed before Roosevelt took office? Were most of them from the previous Roosevelt's time?
Well, there were very few. There were state blue sky laws, as they called them, but they had never really gotten a federal bill through. So the bill that passed during the 100 days, the Truth in Securities Act, was actually very limited. It just required issuers of new stocks to give information about it. But it was the first step towards creating the SEC, which happened later.
The Glass-Steagall Act, which separated investment banks from savings banks, was repealed under President Clinton. So what New Deal economic regulations still exist?
Well, so much. I mean, that the repeal of Glass-Steagall was, I believe, a mistake. But the whole infrastructure that we have now, the Securities and Exchange Commission, as I mentioned, FDIC, the fact that our bank deposits are now insured, all these programs really were developed during the New Deal.
It's interesting that the current economic crisis was fueled by a lack of regulation on Wall Street, people saying, trying to find ways to create new economic approaches that wouldn't be regulated in the banking and mortgage industry. Had people forgotten?
I think they did forget. And in FDR's inaugural address, which we just heard a little bit of, he also talked about, ending speculation with other people's money. There was already a sense that the crash had been started by, crazy speculation on margin in the 20s. We went through that again just now. People had forgotten. And there were people even in the 90s and, and this decade saying, this is crazy. We need more regulation. But they did not have the majority.
But deregulation is something that was a bipartisan effort, wasn't it? We saw an awful lot of deregulation during the Clinton years.
Right, that's true. Although I think there were...
Started during the Reagan years, I guess, and then just continued each administration.
Bob Rubin under Clinton was a big supporter of deregulation. I think
and
they're
now
always...
he's back.
Yeah, he's back again. I think there were always voices in the Democratic Party that were worried about it, but yes, they didn't carry the day.
And what do you think Bob Rubin being in this government suggests, that we're not going to see a push for the kind of a big push for regulation of the sort that FDR did when he took over?
Well, President-elect Obama has said, don't worry about things like that because he's the president and he's going to set the policy. And I think there's lots to be optimistic about with Obama, but we have to worry about that, people around Obama will have a lot of influence. So he really does need to keep some of those tendencies of his advisors in check.
His Barack Obama's appointment for Secretary of Labor is the most liberal person on in his cabinet, also a woman, by the way. But people have said, well, that doesn't matter because the Secretary of Labor has very little clout. The person you've been talking about as having so much clout, Frances Perkins, was the Secretary of Labor, also the first woman ever to have a cabinet position.
Yes, all true. And, there is a parallel because when Frances Perkins became Secretary of Labor, that was a real backwater. The department had only been around for 20 years. It was the least lowest in protocol. She was the last one sworn in. People didn't think that was a very important job. She made it one by pushing really hard for these important programs. So with Hilda Solis, maybe the same thing, that it's not thought of as an important position. But if she becomes the voice for a lot of these issues, she may find herself being the Frances Perkins of today.
Frances Perkins had worked for FDR before, hadn't she? There were a lot of New Yorkers in that administration, at least at the beginning.
Yes. People, I think, sometimes forget the degree to which the New Deal was a New York deal. FDR developed some of these programs as governor, the first temporary emergency relief act giving out relief to the Depression's victims occurred in New York State. Other states followed it. He then created that again at the federal level. But Francis Perkins, Harry Hopkins, FDR himself, all New Yorkers first.
Well, Francis Perkins had witnessed the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire in New York in 1911, and I imagine that was one of the reasons that she became such a strong labor advocate.
It's an unbelievable story. She was literally having tea with a wealthy friend in Washington Square Park in a townhouse, and the butler said, there's a fire. They all ran out, and Frances Perkins saw 146 young women jump to their deaths. And yes, she became a big advocate for factory safety and for workers.
Was she seen as an asset to him politically?
Absolutely. I mean, being the first woman was very helpful because women were voting by then. And yeah, they, you know, she had a connection with workers that was, you know, very helpful.
And did she have a good relationship with Eleanor?
Well, people always thought they would, but they actually were not close, and they were very different kinds of women. Frances Perkins really worked her own way up, went to school, and worked her way up the career ladder. And Frances Perkins once said that she would say to Eleanor Roosevelt, you always say, I feel this, I feel that. Don't say what you feel, say what you know. Perkins was a scientist.
When Roosevelt was governor of New York, wasn't this state the first to, in the country to give unemployment relief during the Depression? Was that something that she had pushed for?
Absolutely. She chaired those commissions early on that advised FDR to be very activist in his response to the Depression and really tutored him on a lot of this stuff. So her role in the New Deal, which was huge and often overlooked, began in Albany.
My guest is Adam Cohn, whose latest book is Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. It's published by the Penguin Press. I was reminded of how similar things are 75 years later when I thought about regulation and the arguments for and against. It must have been difficult to demand more regulations in industry at the time when factories claimed that they weren't financially sound enough to pay their workers anymore and or to pay for improving conditions for their workers. We hear the same sort of thing today when people talk about making factories more environmentally sound or when every time there's a talk about raising the minimum wage, we're told that this is really just going to hurt the workers.
Right. Well, the one thing we saw during the 100 days was the crisis created opportunity. Business wanted a lot of things from government, and they ended up getting some of them, including the right to collude a little bit on prices in the National Industrial Recovery Act. But the progressives demanded important things in return. And that's why in the National Industrial Recovery Act, we saw the first minimum wage, maximum hour, anti-child labor provisions, because we were able to demand things from business. I think that could happen again now.
The TVA has experienced some real problems recently. But how important was that at the time? Tennessee Valley Authority.
Yeah, it was an idea FDR believed in very much. He was a huge supporter of public power. He thought the utility companies ripped people off, and he really wanted to help that impoverished part of the South. Because remember, he was going to rehabilitation in Warm Springs, Georgia. He knew a lot of those rural Southerners. So the idea was a really fine one. He had trouble replicating it the way he wanted to.
Is it still appreciated in the area? Because we're talking about an area that's relatively conservative politically. I'd imagine that if you said we want to create some kind of a socialist program for providing you with utility services, people would be voting against it.
They might well, but you know, I used to live in Alabama, and which was part of the TVA region. And if you talk to older people there, very often there's still a great affection for FDR because they remember what he did for the region.
Well, how much was socialism an issue? Were people complaining that what the New Deal was all about was creeping socialism?
Absolutely. The conservatives said it was all a socialist plot. But, you know, interestingly, the Socialist Party worried about the New Deal taking away their votes because it was running out of a lot of their issues. And Norman Thomas famously said the New Deal is carrying out our platform on a stretcher because he was losing all of his votes to Roosevelt.
Was there a problem because of fear of the the Soviet Union that we were going to be moving down that path?
There was. And in fact, when FDR ran for re-election in 1936, the first time he ran, William Randolph Hearst, who had come to oppose the New Deal and oppose taxes on the wealthy, ran headlines in all of his newspapers saying Moscow endorses Roosevelt. So there was that critique.
Another important figure in the cabinet was Harry Lloyd Hopkins, the Secretary of Commerce. Did he work well with Perkins?
They were great allies. And in fact, she brought him into the administration. There's a great story. The way we ended up with the federal welfare program was Hopkins showed up in Washington early in the 100 days with this great plan for federal relief, couldn't get a meeting with Roosevelt. He ends up with meeting with Perkins, who agreed to see him under a stairwell at a club, and hands her the proposal. She says, I'm going to sell Roosevelt on this. She does. And they were allies ever since.
And in those days, welfare was called relief.
Yes, yes. And there was a lot of support for it because, remember, with that 25% unemployment, people understood that relief was needed.
He also came up with the National Industrial Recovery Act. Did they work together, the two ideas for relief and national recovery?
Well, industrial recovery was a lot of it was a plan for government and business to work together closely. That part of it didn't work so well. But what the NIRA had that was so crucial was $3.3 billion for public works jobs. And that became critical. It also led to eventually the WPA, which Harry Hopkins ended up terrifically running as the great, you know, the great public works program of the New Deal.
Well, Roosevelt had this incredible mandate. Barack Obama had a fairly good mandate, although there are people, I just read that, I think it's Sean Hannity, denies that it's a mandate, even though it was, he said that George Bush had a mandate, which it was a much smaller margin of victory. But, I mean, I guess one man's mandate is another man's non-mandate. Still, doing something as on the scale of the public works that we saw from FDR, it's going to be hard to get through today, isn't it?
It may be hard, but, you know, hard times allow for more innovation. And if things get tough and, you know, we've been seeing 500,000 people losing a job, their jobs each month, if that continues, I think that he'll have a lot of leeway to get creative.
Were the results of the reforms that were issued in Roosevelt's first 100 days immediately felt? How long did it take?
Some of it right away. Harry Hopkins joins the administration on day 79. His first day as federal relief administrator, he sends out $5 million, then a lot of money, to the states who begin immediately handing it out to poor people. And Hopkins keeps writing checks. So that relief went out very quickly. And this was at a time when people were going to garbage dumps and fighting over food. So absolutely. And then the Civilian Conservation Corps put 250,000 young people to work in the forests right away. So absolutely, people could see the change occurring.
And that gave them more added hope?
Added hope and more enthusiasm for Roosevelt. And in the 34 midterm elections, Roosevelt's party, the Democrats, picked up seats, which is very unusual because people saw that things were happening.
When did people start fearing that Roosevelt was gaining too much power?
Well, he was reelected in 36 with a bigger margin than in 32. But in 37, when he began with his court packing plan to try to change the composition of the Supreme Court, which was striking down New Deal legislation, people began to think something was amiss. And it was more difficult for him at that point.
But when you look at the history of the Roosevelt administration and all of the failures, they usually are because he couldn't get everything through, or because he felt that he only could play the hand that he thought he would win.
That's right.
I mean, he was a guy who really understood political expediency.
He was a pragmatist. And when Francis Perkins chaired the committee that created Social Security, that committee wanted national health insurance to be part of it. But FDR could see that the American Medical Association, other people, would block all of Social Security if it was included. FDR was always the one measuring the political possibilities.
How did he answer his critics that he was making the country socialist or taking over too much power?
Well, in 1936, he famously said, you know, these people hate me and I welcome their hatred. So he was very tough about standing up for what he believed in.
What about the people in his inner circle? Were they all true believers?
Most of them were. And they also were, very tough about standing up for what they believed in. Harry Hopkins famously said to a critic of his programs, you know, people don't eat in the long run. They eat every day. He stood up for his program.
How many of them wound up staying in the administration throughout its full term. And this is the longest administration we ever had.
Yeah. Some fell away, but Francis Perkins was there till the very end. Harold Ickes was there till the very end.
Into Harry Truman?
Perkins got a different job under Truman and then ended up leaving under Eisenhower. But for the entire Roosevelt regime, Perkins and Ickes were there. And Harry Hopkins was a close advisor through World War II.
It's unlikely we're going to see anything like that today with Barack Obama or any other president. But do you imagine a first 3 months or so? Six months?
I think in some ways the 100 days has entered people's consciousness. It's now something of a gold standard that the public holds the president to. So I think we will see a lot in the 100 days because I think people will expect it.
Uh-huh. And people in Congress will feel that it is expected and perhaps work a little quicker than they normally work.
Yeah, and they've started to. I mean, they're already talking about the stimulus package now, and the 100 days haven't begun. And I think particularly on stimulus, there's going to be a popular mandate for quick action, and I think we'll see quick action.
If you could come up with a name, because it's really important to label these things. We've had the New Deal. We've had the Fair Deal. We've had the New Frontier. You want to come up with one that you think would work for Barack Obama?
I feel like he's better at this than I am, but I think the words hope and change have to be in there somewhere.
The new hope and change.
Something like that, yeah.
Meanwhile, this book, you must have been getting some interesting feedback from people other than your brother because of all the parallels.
Yeah, no, it's the timing has been perfect. And, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I went to my parents' house and my mom said that George Stephanopoulos had just held the book up on his show and said how great it was. But, of course, being my mother, she said he didn't hold it up long enough.
Well, but I'm sure your mother's read it a couple of times. We have no idea whether Barack Obama has read it.
He mentioned having read a book, and then my own newspaper, the New York Times, did the investigative journalism to find out it was not my book. But that was a few weeks ago, so maybe he's read it now.
And he still has an opportunity. There are still a few days before he actually takes office. The book we're talking about is Nothing to Fear, FDR's Inner Circle and the 100 Days That Created Modern America. It's published by the Penguin Press and written by Adam Cohn, who is assistant editorial page editor at the New York Times, where he's been a member of the editorial board since 2002. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It was a great
pleasure talking with you.
Thank you.